welcome to Alliance Manchester Business School's Original Thinking Podcast. Today's podcast was recorded at our latest Original Thinking lecture. This event series showcases the latest research and original thinking from academic colleagues at Alliance MBS.
When I arrived in Manchester some 20 years ago, I wouldn't have imagined that I would still be here. And I'll be standing in front of you today delivering an inaugural lecture. As you might know, I did my PhD between Spain and Manchester. And back in Spain, my supervisor was Jaime del Castillo, professor of applied economics at the University of the Basque Country, who sadly passed away this summer. So this lecture is in his honor. He was a great mentor and friend, and he was really passionate about regional development. And in his work in Spain, in Europe, in Latin America, he acted as a chain of transmission between academic theory and policymaking. So I learned from him the importance of engaged scholarship, you know, the importance of our work being relevant for policy and practice. And also I learned from him how difficult that can be. You need to be very mindful of context, of the political economy of places and the actors on the ground. And also learned from him that innovation is something that all places can do. You know, all places can be innovative. It's not something that only regions at the technological frontier can do, but also all places, real places, can also innovate to overcome and reverse economic decline. So a good example of how innovation can transform places is my own city, Bilbao, in the Basque Country region in Spain. Growing up, this was a terribly polluted, dirty and green city, blighted by terrorism. This is a photo of the estuary of Bilbao, which is all heavy industry, which was one of the most polluted areas in the north of Spain. My dad worked there in the 70s. He was a director of internal audit at the Altos Hornos de Vizcaya, which was a steel company, which doesn't exist anymore. Move forward 30 years, add a lot of political will, and over 1 billion worth euros worth of investment. And this is what it looks like. A much modern city that in recent years has become a real economic and cultural center and a case study of urban renewal. It is also no surprise that this is one of the places that have shaped many influential ideas around innovation and regional development. Back in the 80s, scholars such as Phil Cook and Kevin Morgan from Cardiff University, and also academics in the University of the Basque Country, like Mika Gomez-Uranga, we're observing the process of decentralization in all industrial regions, such as the Basque region, and how the development of institutions for regional development were helping them out of recession. Research would eventually lead to the conceptualization of regional innovation systems, which stressed the relevance of strong regional institutions and sufficient autonomy for industrial policy and economic resilience. But scholars also included people like Mikel Landavaso, who many of us know, who moved from the Regional Development Agency in the Basque Country to the European Commission, to DG Regio, in the early 90s, and in so doing, spearheaded a new generation of European place-based innovation policies from the innovation actions, the innovative actions of the early 90s, the RIS, the REITs, a lot of acronyms, to the smart specialization strategies of recent years. Well, I'll come back to this, Let me go back to me arriving in Manchester some 20 years ago. What attracted me to Manchester was not the music, well, maybe a little bit. Definitely not the weather, although the rain and the fact that Manchester looks in many ways like my own city made me feel quite at home. That and the lovely colleagues at Manchester University explains probably why I never left. Well, what brought me to Manchester was actually its reputation in innovation studies. You can see here the Maths Tower that was there when I arrived. The great thing about the Maths Tower is that you couldn't miss it. You always knew where to go. In Manchester, colleagues at Press and at Crick were contributing with novel articulations of revolutionary approaches to science and technology policy. Colleagues such as Stan Metcalf and Giorgio laid the brunt of what policy rationales would look like under an evolutionary understanding of innovation and how that linked to the idea of national innovation systems, which was becoming important at the time. Stan Metcalf was one of the main contributors to these ideas. And I think his particular interpretation of national innovation systems as a problem-driven, transient, demand-led, rather than science-driven ecosystem of actors and institutions has stood the test of time a lot better than other views that are now seen as too narrow, static, or functionalist. Luke Giorgio and Hugh Cameron, where is he? Were among others contributing to the theory of evaluation of science, technology, and innovation policy, which we still teach in our executive courses, with concepts such as behavioral additionality. And Hugh, I'm going to be chasing you for that counterfactual paper which you keep telling me about. Evolutionary economics, for those of you who might not know, is rooted in the behavioral theory of the firm, centered on this adaptive behavior and the interaction between this and the selection mechanisms. It rejects the idea of the representative firm and optimal equilibrium of neoclassical economics, and considers variety to be the engine of economic growth, which occurs through path-dependent evolutionary processes that are essentially open-ended and unpredictable. In my work, I've tried to bring together these ideas from innovation studies with regional studies and policy studies. And during my PhD, I was interested in what these evolutionary ideas meant for regional innovation policy, and I applied them to the study of European policies in less developed regions in Spain. And I was interested in how not just the economy, but also policy processes present evolutionary dynamics of selection and path dependence. How there is a linear translation from policy rationales, from theoretical rationales to policy, and how instead policymakers use theory in a selective way to justify policy action. And indeed, their choices tend to be influenced by norms, beliefs, goals, and pressures that differ from those in the academic community. Largely based on the conceptual pillars laid by evolutionary and neo-Sumpeterian scholars such as Stan Metcalf, Carlota Perez, Chris Freeman, and many others in innovation studies, scholars have in the last 10 or 15 years contributed to a rich debate on the rationales, instruments, and implementation of innovation policy. A lot of this debate has taken place in academic networks such as the European Forum for Studies of Policies for Research and Innovation, EUSPRI, of which the Manchester Institute of Innovation Research is a founding member, and regular host of its conferences and events, including the Early Career Conference that we organized earlier this year. And my colleague, Manuel Sanchez Mario Luengo, did a stellar job in organizing and generally in many of the early career research activities in the network. But one of the kind of most remarkable or important change in innovation policy thinking in the last few years has been a shift or a normative turn towards addressing associated challenges such as climate change and inequalities. The point of departure of this so-called kind of new generation innovation policies that often are referred to as challenge space or transformative innovation policies or mission-oriented policies, has been that innovation should not be a policy goal per se, but it should be a means to an end or ends. In other words, that policy should be concerned not just about the rate, but also the direction of innovation. Previous rationales, mainly based on the idea of market failure, basically that R&D investment will be suboptimal if left entirely to the market, are seen as insufficient to tackle these complex challenges and demand a more proactive role of the state. This has been influenced by the literature on socio-technical transitions, which our colleague Frank Hills is a leading contributor. And the emphasis here is on shaping rather than fixing markets and on changing socio-technical systems towards delivering more sustainable outcomes. Government intervention is therefore justified by those failures that prevent such system transformation, such as lack of demand articulation or policy mix coordination. Mariana Mazzucato, she knows, is also well known for her work in this area. And she argues that policymakers have much to learn from the kind of mission-oriented efforts that led to putting a man on the moon when addressing today's challenges. And therefore, she argues that achieving such missions requires a confident entrepreneurial state able to take risks and think big. This expansion of the realm of action for innovation policy means that it is not only becoming a cross-sectoral policy involving, for instance, energy policy or education policy, so the domains are broadened, which of course raises the question of where do you put the boundaries of innovation policy and who owns it, which is not a trivial issue, but also that it includes new and more sophisticated policy instruments, including so-called demand-side instruments such as regulation and public procurement. The debate on the role of demand is of course not new. We in innovation studies, we remember the supplier push versus demand pull debate. But it has seen a bit of a revival in recent years. The work of Manchester colleagues, Luke Georgiou and Jacob Elder, has been very influential here, persuasively arguing that governments should not just do better procurement, but should also procure better things that contribute to innovation in vital government functions and also lead to enhanced innovation capacity and competitiveness of supplier firms. Given that public procurement accounts for some 16% of GDP and around £300 billion a year in the UK, it has enormous potential to influence the size and the sophistication and direction of demand for innovation. For instance, driving the development and adoption of green technologies. What's going on? Okay. Yeah. This trend of work has led to a very rich literature on the use of public procurement of innovation over the last few years, of which Manchester has been an important contributor. This includes work that we did for Nesta and also a project we led for funded by the ESRC, in which we developed the first ever survey on innovation of public procurement in the UK. And this work, collective work, has led to two REF impact cases in the last two rounds of REFs. We continue working in this space, particularly trying to improve the evidence base on the innovation and productivity effects of public procurement. I currently lead with Raquel Ortega Aquiles on a project funded by the Productivity Institute, thank you, and in collaboration with the Connected Places Catapult and other other scholars where we are using administrative data on government spend and contracts to understand how procurement is done, where it's done, and to what effect in terms of innovation and productivity. The expansion of policy rationales, instruments, actors and roles to pursue these new policy goals leads to increased policy complexity and the consequent need to pay attention to potential interactions, conflicts, and tensions between policy goals, rationales, instruments, and implementation across different policy domains and levels of governance. How policy mixes work or don't work together towards a particular objective has become a key focus of the academic literature in recent years, as you can see in the picture here. Initially coined by economists, the concept has been picked up by energy policy researchers, but also by political scientists interested in instrument design. Recently, it has been used extensively by sustainability transition scholars. And in this area, I recently internally examined two PhD theses at the Institute, which brilliantly applied these concepts in their empirical research, looking at policy mixes supporting sustainable housing and electric vehicles in the UK. What these studies tell us is that these mixes of policies, in order to meet their intended outcomes and goals, need to work in a consistent, coherent, predictable, and credible way. And that unfortunately, these characteristics are largely missing in UK innovation and industrial policy. Our work and the work of many colleagues, also at the Productivity Institute, saw how the lack of a long-term approach in UK policy, the fragmented nature of interventions, the poor implementation, and the tendency to chop and change institutions does not generate the industry confidence that is required to stimulate productive investment. So this leads me to the important point of implementation and how we need to, you know, not assume that implementation happens automatically, but it's something that is very messy. So in our work, we have kind of tried to highlight the messiness of policy implementation and the importance of adaptive implementers on the ground that have practical knowledge and can help better understand the problems and the context for a solution, and that can connect opportunities with the capability and resources to act upon them. So in our work, we have discussed the difficulties of conscious or deliberate policy design in the light of this messy policy implementation, but also the dangers of adopting an overly technocratic, top-down, and also place-blind approach to solving societal challenges. And why is this important? This is important because societal challenges such as climate change and inequality differ in their nature from the technological missions of the past. And I believe they cannot be solved through a centralized moonshot approach, as is almost increasingly argued. Richard Nelson, in his 1977 book, The Moon and the Ghetto, highlighted precisely this, questioning how was it possible for a country that accomplished such a remarkable technical feat as putting a man on the moon to be unable to provide an effective education for kids in the private neighborhoods and solve related problems such as drug-related crime. This begs the questions of legitimacy and representation. Who decides the missions and how? The recent documentary film, The Summer of Soul, if you've seen it, about the 1969 Harlem Cultural Festival, which happened precisely on the same days as the moon landing, contains archival interviews on the street in which people lamented that the government was more concerned about putting a man on the moon than about the joblessness and poverty affecting their neighborhoods. Oh, sorry about the slides being cut up. Basically, he says kind of old missions and new missions. Societal challenges are also less likely to require new technological development and instead demand much more mundane diffusion and adoption of existing technologies. And innovations of a different nature, such as institutional, societal, and business model innovations. And yet there seems to be a kind of solutionist or technocratic bias in a lot of mission-oriented innovation policy thinking, places the emphasis on promising technological solutions at the expense of more deeply understanding of the problem, its causes and its solution and consequences. Tackling these problems requires a much more humble, more experimental, and less technocratic approach to policy, as Richard Nelson pointed out in his book, and as an appreciation of the need to improve actors, an appreciation of the need to involve actors with diverse set of ideas, values, and experiences in collective problem solving. This means adopting a much more inclusive and bottom up rather than top down approach, which connects to my third point. What is the role of place? What should be the role of cities and regions in all of this? I think there is a problematic big science or big problems bias in much of this new generation innovation policy thinking on missions that assumes that societal challenges are best or more efficiently dealt with at the national or supranational level, where the right levers, structures, resources, and competencies are more likely to be found. But one problem with this approach is that it excludes most people and places, since it concentrates decision-making and also investment in a reduced number of technologies, firms, and also indirectly of locations, with potentially limited spillovers to the rest of the economy. Even when they claim to be space neutral, policies are never neutral in practice and inevitably favor some sectors and localities over others. This concentration not only increases territorial disparities, but also reduces variety in terms of innovation, leading at best to underutilizing the potential of many innovative firms, people, and places, and at worst, locking them into a vicious cycle of underdevelopment. We see the consequences of this place-blame approach, very clearly in the UK, where policies are often siloed and insensitive to place, and actors on the ground are expected to deliver on a number of policy agendas that are not joined up, often with few resources and limited capacity. The result of this, in terms of entrenched territorial inequalities, is not just an economic problem, but also a source of social and political instability. As Phil McCann and other scholars such as Andres Rodriguez-Posset note, when they talk about the geography of discontent and the revenge of the places that don't matter. So this overlooks the enormous untapped potential of many regions and localities, but also the importance of place as a platform, as an enabler of bottom-up experimentation for problem solving. Global challenges play out in places, and solutions might also face a strong resistance if they're not place sensitive and rooted in a close understanding of the local context. So here we need to recognize that there is a geography of problems as well as a geography of innovation or of solutions. Given these challenges in the UK with the leveling up debate, but also in Europe, it has been argued that a place-based approach is needed, not just to drive innovation and economic resilience, but also address grant-associated challenges that affect people and places. Adopting a place-based approach means that policies will be attuned to the context of different types of victims rather than adopting a one-size-fits-all. And that this will build on unique regional strengths. These debates have also started to acknowledge the dark side of kind of the Silicon Valley or Israel type of startup innovation and growth models in terms of increased social inequalities, but also the importance of more mundane yet essential dimensions of innovation, which is not just about radical breakthrough innovation, but also much more mundane or maintenance type of activities. A good example of an attempt to adopt a place-based approach to innovation policy is the strategies of smart specialization of the European Commission, which I mentioned earlier, which has dominated the agenda of the last 10, 15 years and now is being discussed in the context of the European Green Deal and the net zero challenges. An area which Phil McCann, also Raquel Ortega-Aquiles have done tremendous work. Essentially, smart specialization is a framework to support regions to develop policies that draw on their own resources, place-specific assets, and innovative capacities. Basically, what they're good at. And use those to develop new specialisms that they can branch into. I think this agenda represents a good alternative to a top-down view of mission-oriented policies, or at least a complement to it, and can offer opportunities for all regions, not just core regions or the most advanced ones, to renew themselves and grow. And I think so because of three things, and I'm going to conclude with those three points, which I think are very important in this agenda. So if we're able to adopt this new thinking, I think this, it will contribute to this agenda and to leveling up agenda. First, I think this is important because it adopts a broader view of innovation that goes beyond kind of high tech. It implies that regions should leverage all their strengths, including broader assets such as cultural assets, natural assets, institutional assets, civic values. Often regions are not fully aware of such key assets, which form part of their civic and social infrastructure. But they also should leverage place-specific challenges, because place-specific challenges are not just a problem to resolve, but also a potential source of entrepreneurial opportunity and innovation. And these regional problems, which are often of a more mundane or foundational nature, can be used creatively to encourage adoption of emerging technologies. I was very glad that the Greater Manchester Combined Authority adopted this idea in the recent evidence update of the GM in the Independent Prosperity Review, to which we contributed. It acknowledged that, okay, high-tech innovation in the frontier economy is important, but also we need to consider the foundational economy to lay the foundations of progress for net zero carbon in everyday activities. So both are important. We shouldn't choose one or the other. What do we connect the two? So exploiting the interconnection between frontier and foundational sectors is essential. And in order to do that, we need to adopt a more demand-based approach and a broader set of levers. Our PhD researcher, Osman Aziz, has been working with the GMCA to document examples of regions that have incorporated similar considerations in their regional strategies, such as foundational economy or the donut economics that you might have attended the SEI brilliant lecture last night. The report that Usman put together indicated that foundational sectors such as housing can serve as large target markets for the diffusion of emerging technologies. And a good example of that is Vector Homes, which is a high-tech startup, a fintech startup, and set up of one of our former students of our master's course that aims to produce sustainable modular homes from nanomaterial technologies such as graphene. So that gives you an example of how foundational problems can lead to use of emerging technologies. Also, my PhD student, Matt Siemble, is currently studying the wicked science of housing retrofit in Greater Manchester and how demand for retrofits can be articulated to stimulate market creation and system transformation. A second point is that this, of course, implies adopting a broader repertoire of policy mixes and a stronger attention to demand-side policy tools. For instance, in a recent paper, we discussed how the government of the Galicia region in Spain mobilized all regional government departments to articulate problems that could be could demonstrate the application of UAV-based service solutions to public problems such as fire prevention, control of fisheries, and coastal surveillance, so basically drones. So they managed to create an industrial specialization in this area through the demand side. So they use demand side tools such as public procurement and regulation in a smart way to attract inbound investment and anchor it to place, utilizing external knowledge and capabilities of multinationals to upgrade and diversify regional innovation ecosystems. How these foundational problems or matters of concern become matters of worth demanded in markets is something that we have not paid sufficient attention to. This includes mundane processes of public administration, such as rules, regulations, and public procurement, which are choices that potentially link problems to places and place-based discourses, and that can save ideas about appropriate solutions that can help markets to deliver them. Again, Manchester is a good example of this, which is social value procurement, a topic that also my student Sandra Hamilton is looking at. Finally, this requires institutional capacity and place-based leadership with adequate resources and legitimacy to drive change. It involves leveraging and coordinating the strengths, relations, and civic character of anchor institutions, including universities, as they can play a significant role as conveners and curators of innovation processes at the local level. In this context of institutional building, we are collaborating with the University of Birmingham and the Connected Places Catapult in the setting up of the innovation of an Innovation Procurement Competence Center, which will empower, hopefully, local authorities to use these levers more effectively. In conclusion, so I'll conclude now. You will just know. Starting from some lessons from my late supervisor and mentor, Jaime del Castillo, I have reflected on the relevance of our work for the articulation of public policy, the need to appreciate the challenges of policy implementation, and the importance of place as a platform and a convenient space for experimentation and collective problem solving. But in focusing on place, we need to go beyond narrow metrics and definitions of innovation and adopt a much more broad understanding of regional strengths, including not just knowledge assets, but also place-based values and challenges, as well as all the policy levers available, including inward investment and demand-side tools. This challenge-based and demand-led approach, as we have seen in the Galician region and in other regions, can lead to temporary or transient innovation systems, as Dan McCabe would say, that simultaneously address associated challenges and help upgrade regional innovation capacity and drive up productivity. So to conclude, I believe we need to move towards an industrial and innovation policy that is more place-based, more joined up and more science driven. And I think Manchester is leading the way here already, in this area already, in this exciting agenda. And I look forward to contributing to this in the years to come. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Elvira. And I think the kind of range and the breadth, depth of the issues that we're touching on, I'm sure that there's issues that you are raising that touch ideas, concepts, challenges that everybody here is thinking about. in different arenas. So we do have a little bit of time for questions or observations, comments. Would anyone like to start?
I can talk for hours on this stuff.
Elvira and I have spent many hours talking about these issues, so I would prefer not to do that. First question, Graham?
Yes, it relates to social innovation on the slide.
As you wish.
I wonder what the implications might be for innovative policy, because procurement often goes well. We see a great national scandal right now, but there's a long history of regional procurement and nepotism and all sorts of things. How can we have better governance of this new sort of regional policy making? And other than just a technocratic solution, I'm not totally against it.
So is that the last bit?
Innovative. What innovative policy making? What isn't that also required?
Right, so I think if you take like this kind of policy mix approach, I think you need all of the different ingredients. And in order to use those instruments, you need institutional capacity as well. And so one doesn't can't go with, you know, you can't have one without the other. And there's a time issue as well. So you maybe start with maybe a pilot project and then move from there. Procurement. Actually, the procurement is not the main aspect of it. In fact, I think when you get to the procurement stage, it's actually too late. If you haven't thought about it, what you need first for a long time and kind of engage the market and so on and signal to the market what needs you have. So it's often kind of, the focus on procurement is actually the wrong one. It's kind of that demand articulation that takes place earlier on. And having that vision and the kind of policy capacity to understand how that can connect with other policy areas and broader objectives. Yeah.
At the back on the left.
Do you want me to do some questions from online?
Yes, so, that'd be great.
We have a couple of questions. I'm going to start with this one. At a regional level, where do you see the focus of decision-making, such as organisation, high levels, and how would you identify decision-making?
So where the focus would be on decision-making?
Local, higher, or regional?
I think there's a danger if it's too local that you don't have enough critical mass and levers to operate. Also, if it's too, so there's a kind of, well, there's been a missing middle, hasn't it, for industrial policy where things were too localized or too centralized. So there's kind of a sweet spot in the middle. But also, I think, for certain areas, there should be a kind of collaborative governance as well. So kind of the idea of multi-level governance kind of tells you precisely this, doesn't it? That you need to kind of work across scales. And the kind of hyper-local, hyper-centralized models don't work.
Well, can I ask, what's that in the Basque case? Yeah. I mean, you are Spanish and you're Basque as well. I mean, the Basque country is often held as an example of trying to get that right. Yeah. I mean, what are your observations and experiences of how these things have worked in the Basque country?
So in the Basque country, I mean, it's put often as a kind of model of industrial policy. What I think is done well is that it's been consistent for the last kind of 30 years, and it has been, it has had kind of institutional stability, if you like, for 30 years, and they have been very strongly pushing towards an industrial strategy from the 80s in terms of industrial restructuring, then moving on to and a more active technological policies, like cluster policy and things like that. But they have that developed these institutions for industrial development, which have been quite stable. And so there's been this kind of institutional thickness at the regional level. And also well, they have tax raising powers, of course, so they have a lot of resources and a lot of decision-making capacity. And they had a kind of a vision that has been kind of stable and consistent. So it's been a mix kind of that governance structures, institutional capacity, financial resources, and also able to work across levels, as you say. So they have maybe at the national level, like European level, national level, regional, but also provincial and local. So it's a bit confusing, actually. But they kind of have managed to at least consistently have this drive for industrial policy.
I guess that gives confidence to investors.
Yeah, to investors. Yeah.
Clarity.
Yeah. And also for regional firms, they know kind of where to go for, like for R&D
Funding advice.
Advice for internationalization. So there is a kind of network of innovation support infrastructure, which has been very consistent.
Questions? We have another one from
online.
Okay,
I'm just going to link two together. Okay. What are ways managers to learn from devolution, even though it has a strong identity? Has there been too much of an expectation on places that traditionally have weak support and resources? And do you have any good examples, a regional, national example, that other countries and regions should be?
So what?
Start with, do you have good regional, national examples of other regional or regions or countries that should be looking at?
Okay. Well, I mentioned kind of obviously my the examples that come up to my mind all tend to be from Spain. So I mentioned kind of cross country and also it's like I mentioned Galicia, which has done kind of a very active kind of regional innovation strategy using you know, in a smart way, many policy levers such as procurement. And even investment, so combining all these things. But also, I mean, Germany is a good example. I mean, Phil can speak a lot better than me on the German case. Yes, so what these kind of countries or what these examples show is precisely this stability and the importance of having evolved structures for decision making and enough resources that they can rely on in the long term. Because I think the problem in the UK is that not having that kind of long term or not knowing what resources you're going to have, and often regions kind of competing with each other rather than working together. For limited resources, that unpredictability, I think, is very damaging, especially if you want to solve net zero problems and so on. So hopefully we're moving towards a more
short-termism, instability of institutions seem to be endemic problems to push against innovation.
Absolutely.
Innovation requires long-term
certainty rather than instability.
Thanks for a really interesting sort of review of the developments in innovation policy. I was sort of fascinated by your chart that was missing the headings. I was fascinated by it. You know, the old missions and the new missions. And of course, if you go back into the literature, originally you had sort of the mission-oriented and the fusion-oriented literature. This was sort of Robert Jagras kind of that. So now you have this sort of middle category. And I wonder if you can expand a little bit on that. So what is this sort of middle category of new mission-oriented that seems that elements of the fusion-oriented approach in the past, like Germany, as you mentioned a little earlier. So what's new in the sort of middle category between the old mission and the old diffusion kind of oriented policy?
So yeah, that graph was actually is quite an old table, in fact. So
it was contrasting the kind of moonshot and the defense and so on with the new challenges. And often implicitly, the argument is, you know, challenges are different. So, but there is this implicit bias that we still adopt a kind of moonshot approach, which I think is, even though if you look at Maria Mazzucato's book, she will say you shouldn't adopt the same approach, but often implicitly in the discourse, there is this kind of top-down centralized kind of big science for big problems. So we should be mindful of that if you, this is to solve complex problems that are also place-based. I mean, problems have a place dimension. And how do you start from the other side? How do you start from the problem rather than the technology? And it has elements for diffusion, yes, of course. And we tend to forget diffusion. So it's nothing new in a sense. It's like, okay, well, let's remind ourselves of the importance of diffusion and adoption rather than there's often a high-tech bias and supply-side bias in a lot of policies because they're easier, right? So we tend to forget the more diffusion-oriented, more kind of mundane processes. So in a way, I'm not proposing anything new. I'm just saying, okay, let's not adopt this kind of high-tech centralized top-down bias. So let's not take this moonshot analogy too far.
I just wondered how you might address the potential criticism that a place-based approach is inherently unfair in comparing one place to another. So if you've got a single set of resources available, you've got a single pot of budget or whatever, and you make a decision to apply some resources to a particular place, then that intrinsically suggests that somebody somewhere else doesn't get it.
Yeah, I don't quite see it that way. So you say that there's a kind of
so if you look at United Kingdom as an example, yeah. One of the criticisms of the regional government approach is that England gets the lion's share of the resource. And so any place-based solutions that you might care to introduce in Wales or Northern Ireland, for example, is fundamentally limited because they're not England, and so they're a less well-funded place.
Well, I'll argue that you need to increase the funding in the places that need it the most. I think the opposite is what is happening now, that the places that have more and also have more capacity to bid for things, because they've been very good at bidding for this competitive kind of centralized funding, are the ones that are getting it all. So at the moment, the setting is quite unfair. But if you change it to a system where the places that need the most get the most funding, then you will be able to reverse that. Does that make sense?
Questions? Do we have any more online?
Nothing at the moment.
Nothing at the moment. Oh, there's two more questions at the back. Sorry.
Hi, thank you very much. That was really interesting. I'm really interested in the point you made about is being applicable beyond the traditional kind of hubs and technology and growth and money, and perhaps in places that have kind of wider social problems and multi-generational deprivation and things like that. And that's certainly a case of some of the places that I've worked in that have huge entrepreneurship, really strong communities, kind of really committed people, but they don't get funding. I wonder if you could just expand a little bit on what you think that innovation would look like in a place like
anybody here from Bolton can help me out? Okay, maybe a part of the question, what would innovation in Bolton look like?
What would innovation
be? Where are the assets that Waldorf has? Where is it good at?
Won't say Hogwarts, I mean, Bolton's got a massive industrial heritage, which it probably needs to lean on more. It's massively suffered over recent years. So going back to the lady's point about where investments is needed the most, it's a real challenge. Because I work in the private sector, and we've looked at where we should be investing in different areas of the country. And to invest in Bolton is a really challenging question. And we look at Manchester versus Bolton, and there's an obvious winner from there, unless there's significant incentivization to actually do something different.
So I think
it's a real challenge.
But I think the mistake would be to think, okay, Bolton can be innovative, or Bolton used to be like this other place, also go for this high tech kind of investment. All places have something, have a distinctive strengths and assets that they can build on. And of course, they shouldn't stay in those, they should move. But that should be the starting point. That's it. How can investment and also external investment, import investment, can benefit from that industrial past and heritage, which is really rich in many places, and often we just don't realize we have.
Taking the Northern Ireland example, we've been talking to Northern Ireland, and the one thing they are massively joined up.
Yes,
they understand exactly what their strengths are, what they can actually bring to bear, what's important to them. And it's far easier for them to articulate why you should invest in Northern Ireland compared to some of the other regional areas.
Absolutely. I think you're right. Northern Ireland is doing a very good job in joining the dots and understanding those assets.
We've probably got time for a couple more questions. There was two questions, Marianne and Stein, but
just a comment on Bolton, I think.
Comment on Bolton,
wonderful example that the Bolton Institute was set up to service the textile industry that have a very advanced materials group, because composite materials are essentially textiles. So if you stay still long enough, maybe things come around again. Terminology like rust belt, so that reminds of the installed base, the fact that there are skills that can be repurposed. I guess the example of a Nissan plant drawing on heavy industry into automotive, a lot of work goes into that, but too often we write off locations, certainly follow the walls and places, and yet there is that strength of tradition. And when you come back to this country, you realize there is a huge depth of skills and knowledge to try and look at. As you say, for different ways of life, retrofitting a whole range of things that really can be utilized.
Maybe a couple of questions, Marianne and yourself.
I've had a comment on this sort of theme as well. I just thought around the work being in the regeneration work done in the Tees Valley, where a lot of the old industries sort of died down in the last few years. There's been a lot of investment to sort of harness a lot of the traditional sort of industrial skills that are present in the economy. Regenerating is a good sort of example of where the regional based national policies are working.
Marianne, probably the last question.
Possibly following on from these things, what you've been talking about kind of sounds similar to the progressive procurement approach of the Preston model. Would you advise other places following this model? Because lots of places already are. Wales is active sourcing a lot of services because it's not happy with procurement. What's your opinion on that?
First, it's often not clear what the Preston model actually means. So that's one thing. And it's not just procurement, it's a lot of other things, as you know. But I think what they've done in terms of working with the anchor institutions to agree on a strategy and kind of articulate demand and being consistent, I think it's very, very good. And I'm combining that with other policies. It's not actually been any evaluation of the Preston model, so this is some of the discussions we've been having. But I think looking at the kind of that coherent you are trying to look at all these elements and the power of anchor institutions, particularly in places like Preston, I think is something that all places could learn from, actually.
And then working in the European network.
Yes, and also
it's a learning thing, isn't it?
Also, yeah, and that kind of local but also global strategy of connecting with other places mm-hmm. that might have similar problems. Mm-hmm. And you could, because the solutions that you come up with for your, following that those needs or those challenges locally, if you link up to other locations, then that means opportunities globally for your local firms. So yes, that locally anchored but global strategies, I think. I'm not sure where the Preston is doing that, but I think that's a good strategy.
Stuart, I'm going to hand back over to yourself. Thank you, Elvira.
All right, so a big thank you to Elvira for sharing her insights this evening. Thank you to Philip for facilitating the discussions, and hopefully it doesn't come as a surprise that we look forward to your inaugural lecture in the new year when the original thinking series continues.
Thank you for listening. We hope you found this episode insightful. For a list of our latest webinars, news, and useful business content, please visit ambs.ac.uk.